Welcome to the Buyer Insights Podcast, where we talk about how and why people make decisions to buy. My name is Liston Witherell. I'm the CEO of GoodFunnel. You can check me out at goodfunnel.co on the web. You can also email me directly, liston@goodfunnel.co. I am really, really excited today to have Natalie Nahai, the web psychologist, with us. She's a web psychologist, international speaker, and author of Webs of Influence, The Psychology of Online Persuasion. She's worked with Fortune 500 companies, including Unilever, Google, and Harvard Business Review, and she helps businesses apply scientific rigor to their website design, content marketing, and products. Natalie also speaks at conferences, and she's even held one of her own called Humanize the Web, which is coming up on its second edition, coming in June of 2017. Before I get to the interview with Natalie, I just want to thank you for being here. If you're enjoying this show, please do review us on iTunes, subscribe here, share the channel, anything you can do to support us. And really, if you know anybody else who would get something out of listening to this, please do share it with them. You can also find out all about what we've written on conversion rate optimization, email marketing, content marketing, and ethical marketing for your business really is what we like to focus on understanding how and why people make decisions for your business. So if you're interested in any of that, or if you're looking for direct help with your business or marketing, check us out on the web, goodfunnel.co. And without further ado, here's Natalie. How are you, Natalie?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am really good. Thanks for asking. And I'm excited to have you here on the show. You are, I don't know if you dubbed yourself this, but you go by the web psychologist, which obviously for the purpose of this show is immediately interesting. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you became the web psychologist?
Sure. So back in the day when I was doing a degree in psychology, I wasn't really thinking about how it might apply online. And it was only later in my mid-20s when I started looking into web design and development, I was a freelancer, that I started thinking about how our online environments influence our behaviors. And I thought it was a theme that was so obvious to me that would be interesting to know about, especially if you're trying to sell to people or connect with people, that I was really surprised that there wasn't that much literature around it. You know, UX wasn't yet a thing. There wasn't much in the way of behavioral sciences and their application online. And so when I looked for the literature, I didn't really find any. So I thought, I'll write the book. And then because there wasn't a term to describe what it is I was writing about, it's like, well, psychology online or behavior online, I thought that it would make greater sense to call it web psychology because it's familiar enough for people to get a sense of what it is and then hopefully concise enough for people to be able to, yeah, to recognize fairly quickly what might be involved.
And as the web psychologist, it seems like you've used this phrase, humanize the web, which I know you had a conference last year about that, and hopefully have another one coming up here in June. Of 2017.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. Yeah.
I'm sure it will happen. What is the need there? Why do we need to humanize the web, and how has it not been human enough?
Oh, such a good question. I think when I think about humanizing the web, it's more about the greater qualities, the higher qualities that we can bring to interactions online. So if you think about the good relationships in your life. So it could be friends, it could be your parents, it could be a partner or partners. The idea that we enter into these relationships consensually, we help the other person to grow, they help us to grow, there's trust, there's a nourishing of all the parties involved. And I think that's humanity at its best. And when we're looking at how to kind of bring that to the ways in which we interact online, especially between businesses and their customers, I think the question of ethics and trust and good relationship is one that hasn't yet really come to the forefront of what we're doing online. So people think still about short-term gains, quick wins, how to convert people, how to sell more, how to advertise in a more personalized way, outside of the context of, well, what does it mean to actually build trust with our customers? And that was really the reason that I wanted to start exploring how tech influences our lives, for good and for bad. And then next year, taking a more product-based focus at, well, how can we use psychological principles and persuasion in a way that facilitates our customers and creates a better experience in a mutually beneficial relationship.
Yeah, you know, you said a really dirty word in online business, in particular, ethics. You know, it's something we think a lot about, because when we're doing, say, a lead generation project, you know as well as I do, if our client, you know, what our goal is to maximize good qualified leads, where the people who come through understand what the product is, first of all, they understand why they're putting their information in, and they understand what they should be getting in return. It would be much easier, though, if our client comes back to us and says, you know what, we need more leads. All we do is reduce the number of form fields, or we make promises that we can't fulfill, right? But that's not in anybody's best interest. That's not how we do business, but I think there's always an urge to do that. So what are some psychological principles that we can use in order to you know, maintain our own ethics and feel good about doing business the way we do it?
Oh, that's a good question. So using psychological principles within your decision-making as a business. I think less than principles and more like trends. If you look at the kinds of messages that are most persuasive, they tend to be those that are given to us by homophilous sources. So sources that are similar to us. And homophily is a principle of associating and bonding with similar others. So if you're interacting with a company that has similar values to you, so for instance, say you're interacting with a company that certified one of the B corporations and they have good social and environmental impacts with their bottom line, that's going to be a company which you're much more likely to trust and give more of your information to. And I think that's the crucial thing, that we're actually surprisingly willing to give a huge amount of information up to those companies and businesses that we believe in. And so if you can find a way to do that, that's going to be the best thing to do. So putting your values first, being explicit about what they are, and then focusing on the long-term gains and the advocacy and positioning yourself as a brand that people can trust, which then really helps offline word of mouth as well as online, which means that when things go wrong, your brand is much more likely to be resilient because people will protect you and go to bat for you, and they're much more likely to forgive your brand if you, you know, make a giant cock up on social media, for instance.
Yeah, we have a presidential candidate who does that a lot. Yikes.
Yeah,
we don't touch that.
Well, yeah.
So when we think about, or when I think about web psychology, I think there's really two huge things at play. One is the human being, right? The way we're hardwired to think, act, behave, make decisions, take in stimuli in the world. Mm. And then there's also this other piece, which is the technology and the web itself, which is changing a lot. So the person isn't changing nearly as much or as fast, but the web is changing really, really quickly. So how do you think human interaction and decision-making on websites has changed over time during your career that you've been studying this?
Well, I think there's a few things to mention. The first is that we expect things to happen quickly. So just the simplest example to give is if your page isn't loading fast enough, whether on mobile or desktop, you're going to lose customers. And that's something which is very firmly established. Hierarchy of information, because you consume so much, we have typically a lot less attention because it's fragmented over various devices, whether it's, you know, your mobile and the TV or someone's ringing or whatever it is. So I think making sure that there is a very easy way for people to pick up the most salient or important information on the page. So that could be reducing the amount of content, making the headlines higher contrast, bigger, etc. I think the other thing that I'm really interested in, which actually surprisingly it comes up again and again as a big mistake that companies make, is the lack of congruence or matching between the visuals that you use, whether that's a photo or it could be a video thumbnail or it could be an infographic, whatever it is, and the headline or the text for that particular piece of content. So if you have an image of someone and she's looking quite uncomfortable and you're selling insurance to help people feel less uncertain, and the question is something like, we'll protect you when your house burns down, because the burning down of the house is a negative feeling and it's matched by the body language of the woman in the picture who looks like she's feeling uncomfortable, you're much more likely to process that message more quickly, and therefore trust what's being said. So I think congruence is another thing that we look to subconsciously to inform whether we can trust the content on a page.
And so does it create, say, cognitive dissonance if you're looking at a page where there's not a match, which requires much more thinking on the part of the user?
Yeah, exactly. But so the interesting thing here is that when you have that dissonance, if you're doing it deliberately, so you have something like an image of something which is really miserable, and then a really funny tagline, or for instance, a cute image and a bad tagline, like, you know, grumpy cat. So I don't know, he might say something absolutely horrific, like, your mother stinks of chinchillas or something, I don't know, something random. Because it's paired with something that has different has a different emotional valence to what the message says, it can also be quite funny. So that mismatch can actually generate a sense of amusement. So I think it's just about figuring out whether it works for you or it might work against you, and then making the choice accordingly.
Now, so I've done lots of courses and taught people about copywriting and, you know, what makes a good headline, what makes a bad headline, you know, why do certain things work and others don't. The one question I get almost uniformly every time I talk about the subject is, isn't it true that nobody reads anymore? and I always say, well, you read something in order to come to the class, so that can't be true. What do you say to that? I mean, do you find in your work that people have such low attention spans that they're not willing to read?
No. I think if that were true, then people would not be reading books. Bookshops would have gone out of business, especially with things like Amazon taken over. That hasn't happened. I mean, bookshops have, but people are still reading, and more so than they were previously, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. You've also got the huge success of websites such as Medium, and that's a literary platform in the sense that these are articles that you read. Also, walled, you know, paywalled journalistic content. So if you look at the Times, that's paywalled, and people pay for that content and they go long form and they do read. So I think it's a very easy thing to say that people don't read. And I think in certain contexts, if we can digest information more easily, then we will. But that doesn't mean that people aren't willing to commit time to reading something if it's of value and if they're interested, if their motivation is high enough.
Yeah, you know, my feeling is people just want to know really quickly whether or not they should read it, if it's for them or not. Because we are kind of in this mobile state, as you said, you know, we're always being bombarded by notifications and distractions. So I'm going to put you on the spot here. I did this to Ollie also.
Oh, great.
Now, because we're so busy, right, and we're kind of moving from the desktop age where we're consuming most of our information on a larger screen to kind of an on the go, you know, I'm going to spend 2 minutes, pull my phone out of my pocket because I'm feeling awkward at the local cafe or whatever. Right. Given that people have kind of a, by definition, a lower attention span, less amount of time on that mobile experience, how should companies differ the mobile experience from the way they've approached the web historically?
Well, I think visually, the way in which you present your information is going to make a big difference. So if you think about the kinds of actions that people take, typically many of them are in app, and not just any app, but mostly the major social media platforms. So if you are serving ads in that particular platform, or I don't know, it could be like a link to something, then typically to grab attention, you're going to want to take a primarily visual approach, so using images that are going to be appealing to people. So high saturation works well, high contrast, something which leaves a certain amount of the imagination, so something which is a bit mysterious. All of these sorts of things are going to help grab attention more quickly. And the other thing also to mention is that motion obviously is very attention grabbing. So if you're using a GIF or you're using an autoplay video, which is now obviously the standard for Facebook ads, it's going to grab people's attention more quickly. The problem, of course, is that this is just basically an arms race until people become desensitized, much like they did to banner ads, to videos, etc., or GIFs that they might see online. So, yeah, it's just kind of going with what works, trying these particular approaches, but then making sure that you're delivering value so that instead of trying to grab attention, you're encouraging people to create habitual forms of engagement so that they go to you first to find out X, Y, or Z on a particular topic. And I think that's the longer term strategy that's going to be the most successful.
Yeah, okay. Do you think it's fair to say also that typically in a mobile experience, you should choose your calls to action more carefully? So for instance, what I see the trend going to is one dominant call to action and really removing all other choices from the page in order to focus the user on the most important thing, knowing that you're not going to get much of their attention.
Yeah, so a single action and then making it as concrete as possible and as easy to complete as possible. So I know that we were talking about form fields, but people are not going to stand there and type away on their phones unless it's, for instance, a product that they really want to buy that they're willing to put their card information in for. So I think people's motivation tends to be much lower and their ability to execute complex commands is much lower. So yeah, making something simple and easy to execute is definitely going to be a better approach on mobile.
I was having a conversation with a good friend of mine named Dan Gamito the other day, and we both kind of came to the conclusion that marketers are extremely self-centered. And what I mean by that is marketers spend so much time thinking about how many emails we should send and how often should we tweet and how many offers should we put on our website. And it kind of presupposes that people are sitting there always thinking about you. Right? Like they're sitting there going, oh, I wonder what Liston's doing right now. What I haven't heard from him in a while. Do you think that we should be obsessed with that? And does over communication negatively impact the buying experience?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, if you're over communicating to a given person, then it's going to be frustrating and they're going to want to have less of you. And it's better to have people wanting more, but then to do that, you have to create a good experience. So I think I generally tend to err on doing less frequently and then making sure that the quality is high. Because you can play the numbers game. And I think if you're the kind of person or brand that does, for instance, loads of webinars and you've got a funnel and you're basically playing a numbers game where you're trying to get as many people through the first gate and then you're upselling them things, then obviously you're going to want to send out a lot of content. That's not the approach that I like to take, because I would rather serve something of higher content and build relationship, which is kind of what I hear you saying about the approach that you think is possibly better. So I think, yeah, less is more. And also if you're in doubt, just asking people, just saying, look, does this content fulfill you? Does it meet your expectations? Is there something in particular that you'd like to hear more or less about? And you can do this once a year, like an annual thanks to your customers and asking them to kind of feedback. And that I've found in the past that that's been really helpful, because then people feel like they actually have a stake in what you produce. And that's a really good thing to feel.
Right. And from a purely mechanical standpoint, it creates a micro conversion, right? They're engaged with you and they're giving you feedback and they're taking a step towards you, which is really important in any relationship.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you've been doing this for a while. What do you know now about web psychology that you wish you would have understood when you started?
That's such a good question. What do I wish I'd known when I started? I think I would have liked to have known more about the misuse of personal data and the possibilities for misuse of collecting psychographic data, because then I think I would have been more vocal about it much sooner. And I think it's only in the last couple of years that we've started to see the potential for large-scale, covert, non-consensual data collection and its implications that psychology can help to facilitate. And so it's that kind of whether you're using these things for good in a win-win situation or for bad in a win-lose. So I think I wish I'd have known earlier the potential for that and to be able to flag it earlier.
Okay, so this sounds like gossip, which I love. So I'd actually like to hear more about that, and I'm sure you'd like to anonymize any example you give, which is fine, but can you tell us a little bit about some of the trappings of misusing data?
Well, I can give you some very obvious examples. So I think the first thing to note is this is more of a cultural issue, at least initially, I think, to an extent. Although you may have different ideas about this, I'm interested to hear. But I know that a few years ago, Facebook released some information about a large-scale study that they'd done, and it was in collaboration with Cambridge University and some friends of mine who'd actually run the experiment. Now, this experiment was consensual. They had, I think it was in the region of just under 60,000 participants who conducted a whole barrage of psychometric tests to measure their personality traits and things like their gender, their age, sexuality, all sorts of things. And basically, what Cambridge were able to do was to find correlations between all of the traits and the results that they had arrived at through the psychometric testing. And they correlated that to specific patterns of liking of whatever brands and products and pages and content on people's Facebook pages. So what they were able to do was to take those findings from the initial consensual research data set and apply all of that information to create an algorithm which could then predict with a high degree of accuracy whether you or i.e. people who have not explicitly contractually agreed to have this research conducted on our profiles, they'd be able to extract the information from your and my profiles about what we like, to be able to make inferences about how extroverted you are, whether your parents are divorced or together, whether you're likely to take drugs, or whether you're likely to have different varieties of sexual experience or proclivities. And so they were able to do all of this. And then, of course, they come out with this the press release, thinking this is really cool, not realizing that a whole bunch of users on the site are going to go, hang on, so you can tell what about me? And this is stuff that I wouldn't even tell my best friend. And so I think that kind of stuff, where there aren't any ethical boundaries that would be in place in the real world, really made me double think about what the implications might be for things like religious groups who want to, for instance, take action against people of particular sexualities or minorities, or things like people's premiums for insurance companies or medical care or whatever it might be. There are so many real-world applications for that kind of discrimination that I think, yeah, I think that's one of the biggest areas which is potentially going to be incredibly problematic.
Well, and we do know how accurate the analytics can be, and the predictive models can be. You've, I'm sure, read The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg, where he gives an example of someone in data analytics at Target, the large big box store. And they were able to predict with pretty good accuracy whether a woman was pregnant or not based on her buying habits. Do you remember this story?
And she was, wasn't she? I believe she was 16, and they put a flyer through through her home box, letterbox, and the father found it and then accused the company of encouraging his daughter to be sexually active. It's like, why have you sent me this stuff? And then they actually kind of said, well, actually, we found that the targeting is pretty accurate. And then she had to come clean, is what I remember of it. I'm not sure if that's
No,
entirely accurate. Maybe
no,
you can
you're totally
correct
right. And what an amazing story that is, and also kind of
me.
scary. And you know, I think Facebook, you talk about ethics, is going to require a large conversation about how much manipulation is okay, because we know that they want to show us stuff that gets us more likely to interact and have a pleasurable experience, and therefore they're editing the web, which is kind of scary. So that's a larger conversation than we have time for here. But now, Natalie, I have three questions that I ask all of my guests. And so the first one for you is, what is the biggest mistake people make in learning about their customers?
They make assumptions and then create personas without doing any primary research into who their customers are, what their needs are, their motivations, and their psychographic information.
I totally agree with that. What is the one thing everyone can do today to learn more about their buyers?
They can ask them a question like, What is it that you value most about our business, and how can we serve you better? I know it sounds super simple, but you'd be amazed how much amazing and rich qualitative information you can get from that.
And what is the one book you recommend besides your own, which we'll get to in a second?
The one that I recommend, if you want a grounding in sort of the behavioral science principles, would be the now established Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. It's quite a big read, but it's absolutely essential if you want to have a deep and academic sort of understanding of how and why we think the way that we do, to the best of the knowledge that we have at this point in our research.
Yeah, I highly recommend that. That's on our reading list here at Good Funnel, and also a related book, just to add to that, if you're interested in the topic that Kahneman covers. There's another book by Richard Thaler called Nudge, which kind of builds upon Kahneman's work. Great recommendation. So we've covered a lot of ground here. Thank you so much for being with us, Natalie.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So you have a book that you've published in its first edition, and you're coming up with a second edition. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So it's Webs of Influence, The Psychology of Online Persuasion, and it came out in 2012, and I've now rewritten about two-thirds of it and updated the rest, and the new version will be coming out in April 2017, and there's whole new sections in there. So if you feel moved to check it out, you should be able to in the new year, or you can just tweet to me and I can tell you about it.
Perfect. So where can people find you? On Twitter, obviously.
Yeah, so on Twitter at Natalie Nahai, and then if you want to find my website, it's natalienahai.com, and there are loads of, actually there's a lot of recommended reading on there. If you go to the resources section of other books, including Kahneman's, if you're interested in checking out the wider field of behavioral science.
Well, fantastic, Natalie. I really enjoyed our conversation today. I know the listeners have gotten a lot out of it, so thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for your time.